Morning, everyone. Let's get started. We're on the series Vulnerability, the Good and the Bad, week four. So I just want to start just with a quick review of last week. So last week we looked at her chapter, Brené Brown's chapter, to Wholehearted Living, which includes being vulnerable and so on. And it was the chapter which she called Courage, Compassion, and Connection. She said that courage comes from the word cor, which is the Latin word for heart, meaning that courage is not heroism, but rather being able to be from the heart, honest and open about who we are, the good and the bad, the good and the weak, and so on. And the courage we talked about is in the simple things of life, something like saying, I don't know, or I don't understand, or having a difficult conversation where you expose yourself, or just being honest with other people and being authentic about the pain that we have as it is now, and so on and so forth. And to explain, for this we need compassion. Compassion means not to respond to pain by protecting it, both in ourselves and others, or dismissing it, or judging it for that matter, but rather, as she puts it, suffering with. Either with ourselves or others, to accept it, to accept the weakness within ourselves, the pain within ourselves, the pain within others. She then went on to explain the connection between boundaries and compassion, which we explained last week. You have to be a little bit careful with, because we need to balance boundaries with selfishness and, or not being selfish, I should say, rather selflessness. And we talked about acceptance and how that fits in with values and so on, which we'll talk a bit more about today. And of course, all of this leads to connection, which she explains. Connection is, we talk about real connection with someone else in a real way, which of course is something we all need, because we're all wired for the necessity of connection. Before we go on, I just wanted to say today's shiur we're going to dedicate to the neshama, the soul of Ruth Bat Avraham, which is Rita's mother's yahrzeit was last week. The neshama should have an aliyah, and the whole family should only be benched with good things. So we're going to go on to the next part of the book, which I'll explain in a moment. I have to be honest, I'm struggling with this book. Yeah, I'm being vulnerable, you see. I'm struggling with it because, you know, most of the books that I've shared with you, Jewish or not, I normally love. And, okay, we pick up a few points here. We normally give the Jewish perspective. Some things we agree or disagree, whatever the case is. But here, there's an underlying theme throughout the whole thing that I'm really finding very difficult and fundamentally disagreeing with, actually. And the truth is, I was thinking about this morning, it's actually not only from a Jewish perspective. It's just from a value-based perspective. It doesn't matter what kind of religion it is necessarily, particularly from a Jewish perspective. Obviously, my frame of reference is Torah Judaism, but because I think, and I think a lot of what Brené Brown says, or maybe to be fair to her, a lot of how she's being interpreted, maybe, is, I think, contributing to the, I mean, a lot of stuff is excellent, but a lot of the stuff what she's saying, I think, or what's being interpreted, is contributing to the selfishness of today's society, to the victimhood of today's society, to the fragility of today's society. I think it's problematic, and I think that's why, when I say I've struggled with it, I don't mean I'm struggling in a sense of finding it boring or hard to read and difficult to talk about. I'm struggling with the concepts, and I think actually it's for that reason it's even more important to talk about it, so we can actually sift out, at least from my perspective, to sift out the stuff which is really good and the stuff which is, I think, problematic. And I think the underlying theme, and we'll talk about it a bit more today because I think it comes out strongly, the underlying thing is about who we really are, in terms of our own identity, number one. I don't think she researched and has much understanding on the layers of the soul. That's fairly evident. And also just the whole concept of value-based living, right, which of course is so fundamental to so many different perspectives, a particularly Jewish one, of course, right? Because it's all about living for a higher cause, living for a higher purpose, living for meaning, and so on. So, just I guess that's just putting in context some of my what's the best word to describe them? Not rants, but some of the stuff that I'm having problem with as we go on. It's really one continuous theme which we'll talk about. Okay. So in her book, before she goes into the chapters of the specific areas where vulnerability and being authentic manifest itself, she has sort of another introductory chapter, which I'm not going to go into at great length because we've talked about some of the stuff already, but just wanted to just highlight a few points from it, and then we'll go on to the actual chapters. So it's a chapter called Exploring the Power of Love, Belonging, and Being Enough, which being enough is the problem, which we talked about last time. So she says, love and belonging are essential to human experience. Yeah? So as I conducted, she says, my interviews, I realized that the only one thing separated the research participants who felt a deep sense of love and belonging for the people who seemed to be from the people who seemed to be struggling for it. The one thing is the belief in their worthiness. Now this is fundamentally true, right? The feeling of worthiness, as we talked about, is really, really important. And she defines, she says, often worthiness, and this is a mistake of today's society, which is correct, often worthiness comes from the future. What she means is that people tend to feel, I'm going to be worthy when, I don't know, I lose a lot of weight. Well, I'm going to be worthy when I can stay sober. I'm going to be worthy when everyone else thinks I'm a good parent. I'm going to be worthy when I'm independent and can make a good living, right? When I can hold my relationships together, all those kind of things. That's a fundamental mistake because we're worthy always, right? And I think that's the core, that's the good part of what Brené Brown is trying to work on. That's feeling of positive self-acceptance, which comes from a feeling of worthiness, and to us to get to the point that we're always worthy, right? We always have intrinsic worth. And that's really, really important. And she says, here's what's truly at the heart of wholeheartedness, right? Remember, vulnerability is about showing up wholeheartedly, your whole self. So the heart of wholehearted living is worthy now, not worthy when, but worthy now, which is really, really important. And then she talks about the concept, of course, that love is connected. Everyone wants to be loved, and everyone needs to love. That's part of relationships. But love comes with a sense of belonging. You can't love something unless there's a connection, there's a belonging, that you belong to the group or you belong to the person, they belong to you, and so on and so forth, right? And a deep sense of love, she writes, and belonging is an irreducible human need from the moment we're born until the day we die. And the absence of love and belonging will always lead to suffering, which is true. I mean, this is a researched fact that good relationships increase health, increase longevity, and so on and so forth. But as we know, and sort of described here in this chapter as well, love requires a love of self. And I say love of self, I mean a healthy love of self, right? Not egocentricity, but a healthy love of self, or a healthy dose of self-acceptance, because we know that the emotion of love requires someone to love. You can't love a nobody, but you also can't be a nobody and love, right? Because loving means I love. There's an I, right? There's an I in love, which is something we talked about when we talked about love and respect. That's why respect needs to always balance out love, because the I in love is very important. The only problem is sometimes it can derail into a negative I, into an egocentric I. That's why, you know, it needs to be that balance. But there does need to be an I. You can't love if you're a nobody. No one wants to be loved by a nobody, if you know what I'm saying, right? You want to be loved by someone. The more the someone is a someone, the more you feel loved, right? So the connection, the love, all that stuff needs. I mean, we even have even the verse. One of the interpretations of the verse in the Torah, "Love thy neighbor as yourself." Ahavta recha kamocha, right? So on a simple level, it means love people like you love yourself. Always don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself, and so on. But also means ahavta recha. When can you really love your neighbor? When kamocha, when you have the self love, when you have self acceptance. Otherwise, it's very hard to love. And the thing that stands in the way of real connection and real love and loving oneself is what she spoke about in the beginning of the book, which is the concept of shame, right? And she says in this chapter also, we all have shame, we're all afraid to talk about shame, and the less we talk about shame, the more control it has over our lives, right? So the more things we're ashamed of, the more things we feel unworthy of, the more things we want to hide, the more things we want to sort of, push under the carpet, the more it has control over us, and we live our lives based on that shame, which is a barrier to really connecting with someone, showing up wholeheartedly, being honest, being authentic, and so on. So shame, as she writes at the end of the chapter, shame is basically the fear of being unlovable. It's the total opposite of owning our story and feeling worthy. In fact, the definition of shame that I developed from my research... So, and then she just touched on the concept, and I'm going to finish with that and go into the next chapter, is obviously we need to understand the difference between shame and guilt, right? So shame is when you feel ashamed of a weakness. Guilt is when you... Guilt, or positive guilt at least, is when you... I mean, we once talked about positive shame as well, but that's for another time. But the difference, the regular difference between shame and guilt is shame is negative when you feel ashamed and unworthy for a weakness that you have. Guilt is about feeling uncomfortable about it so you can take responsibility and fix it. And the two are very, very different. I'm talking about healthy guilt, right? Okay. Good. So then after she introduces, after these two introductory paragraphs, she goes into a whole, I think it's like 10 chapters, which she calls guideposts. Guideposts basically are the different areas of life where this concept of wholehearted living, being authentic, vulnerability, positive vulnerability, and so on, shows up. Right? And the mechanisms and the tools and the strategy to develop that safe vulnerability and that positive vulnerability and so on. So the first one is called cultivating authenticity, right? In other words, how do we become authentic? And the subline is letting go of what people think. Okay, that's a hard one, right? But that's really the core of the whole issue, right? Letting people go, because you can't really be authentic if you live your life based on the perception of other people. Okay. So being authentic means obviously that we know we strive to be real, not live through others and not live through pleasing other people necessarily, but living who we are and being authentic about who we are. So what I want to do is, I want to just read to you some of the excerpts of this chapter and then unpack it all, the part that is good and the part which I think is problematic. Okay. So she writes like this, authenticity is not something we have or don't have, right? Because generally people like authentic people. That's where it goes, right? So you say, that person is really authentic. But authentic is not a being, it's not a state of being, it's not who you are, right, or what you have. It's a practice, it's a conscious choice of how we want to live. Which also means, by the way, that some days we can be more authentic than others. It all depends on the choices we make that day, right? So authenticity is a collection of choices that we have to make every day. It's about the choice to show up and be real, the choice to be honest, the choice to let our true selves be seen. Now, the idea that we can choose authenticity makes most of us feel both hopeful and exhausted. We feel hopeful because being real is something we value. So if we learn how to be authentic, it makes us hopeful. So we can be authentic, we can be real. It's not something we're born with or born without, it's something we can work towards, right? But we feel exhausted because without even giving too much thought, most of us know that choosing authenticity in a culture that dictates everything from how we are supposed to weigh to what our houses are supposed to look like is a huge undertaking, right? So it's a daunting thing to be really authentic and just live our lives based on who we are, as opposed to how society dictates. And then she says a really important sentence which you're going to unpack soon. Authenticity is the daily practice of letting go who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are. Right? That's a good line. So again, it's letting go who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are. And therefore, she says, choosing authenticity means cultivating the courage to be imperfect, to set boundaries, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, exercising the compassion that comes from knowing that we're all made of strength and struggle, and nurturing the connection and sense of belonging that can only happen when we believe that we are enough. We should replace that by worthy, not enough. Okay. And then she says, wholehearted living and loving, even when it's hard, even when we're wrestling with the shame and fear of not being good enough. And then she quotes an interesting thing. She says that Cummings, the poet Cummings, wrote the following: to be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you everybody but yourself, means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight and never stop fighting. Okay? That's a good line. In other words, it's a society which makes us want to be everyone except for ourselves. Yeah? Staying real is one of the most courageous battles that we'll ever fight. Then later she says like this, she says, it's not so much the act of authenticity that challenges the status quo. I think of the audacity of authenticity. Most of us have shame triggers around being perceived as self-indulgent or self-focused. We don't want our authenticity to be perceived as selfish or narcissistic, right? So what you're saying is, people who strive for authenticity and are vulnerable and therefore need to be who they are, need to set boundaries sometimes, need to be honest with themselves, often are afraid, but I don't want this to come with criticism of other people. I don't want to displease other people, right? And that's a problem, because that's got the two don't go together. You know, it's interesting, in the Megillat Esther, everyone talks about Mordechai and the story of Purim. And through the story of Purim, Mordechai really was upgraded even greater than he was before, and he became a leader of the Jewish people at the time. And in the very, very end verse, it talks about Mordechai being Ratsui Lerov Echav. He was a person that was accepted and pleasantly accepted by most of his brethren. And the commentators pick up on that. That's a very interesting phrase, most of his brethren. Why not everyone? He was such a great leader. Why not everyone? Truth is, because you can't. You just can't be accepted by everyone. That's a person who everyone is pleased with is a problem. Probably they haven't done much, or they haven't been honest enough, or they haven't accomplished much, whatever the case is, right? Like no one has a problem with the person that you don't know about, right? And you've never seen and never interacted with. So that's a struggle of being authentic, being honest, being standing up for who we are as opposed to who everyone else is. We strive for that. We all would strive for authenticity. The problem is, what stands in the way is what it's going to do to the other people's perception of us.
If you're truly authentic, you shouldn't care.
Right.
There's a fine line between self-preservation, as you say, and what they...
Correct, but truly authentic... Yeah, but you have to get to that point of being truly authentic. As we're saying, it's a practice, right? And making that leap to become truly authentic is difficult because we need to move away from that worry about what other people are going to think. Right? And risk, like even relationships, right? Vulnerability, good vulnerability, actually increases the relationship, as we've been talking about, makes it stronger because we relate with the whole self. But most of us don't do that properly because we're afraid of breaking the relationship. I can't let that person ever know that X, Y, and Z, right? Because I'm afraid what they'll think of me and they might not want to relate to me. It's counterintuitive because really it's the other way around. If it's a real friend, if it's a real relationship, then it should be one of trust and one of love and one of connection and one of where you can show up wholeheartedly and not be judged and not be criticized, right? But nevertheless, it's not so simple. Sometimes choosing being real over being liked is all about playing it unsafe. It means stepping out of our comfort zone, right? That's what you write, which is true. As we struggle to be authentic and brave, it's important to remember that cruelty always hurts, even the criticisms that are untrue. We go against the grain and put ourselves and our work out in the world. Some people will feel threatened. They'll go after what hurts the most, our appearance, our lovability, our parenting, and so on. The problem is that when we don't care at all what people think, and we're immune to hurt, we're also ineffective at connecting. So she's saying an interesting thing, that we can't not care completely what people think because then we just become cold, right? In other words, you can't numb our feelings also. So that's got to... Yeah. So courage is telling our story, not being immune to criticism. Staying vulnerable is a risk we have to take if we want to experience connection. If you're like me, practicing authenticity can feel like a daunting choice. There's a risk involved in putting your true self out in the world. But I believe there's even more risk in hiding yourself and your gifts from the world. And she says that we need to go around with this caution sticker that says, caution, if you trade your authenticity for being liked, you may experience the following: anxiety, depression, eating disorders, addiction, rage, blame, resentment, and inexplicable grief, which is true. Right? The insecurity of people who at an extreme live their lives all around the perception of others actually leads to unhappiness in not being content, often anxiety, depression, and so on and so forth. Okay. That's the sum of this chapter. So it's about building and practicing authenticity. So let's really analyze this and unpack it. So let's just go back to two sentences that she says. First of all, in the beginning she says, authenticity is the choice to be honest the choice to let our true selves be seen, right? And the other incredible sentence was, letting go of what we think we are, letting go of what we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are, right? The number one question, however, that we need to really examine in all of this is, what does it mean to embrace ourselves? Who are we? Right? What does it mean to be ourselves, right? You follow the question?
Yeah.
What does it mean embracing ourselves? What does that mean? As we've talked many times, we are very, very multi-layered. What part of me is me? And what part of me do I have to embrace to really understand my self-worth, right? So let's break this down by, you know, some Jewish concepts and some sort of sources, right? Now, on the one hand, this concept of being authentic and understanding individuality, how everyone has a different self to a certain degree, is important and it's true. So there's a famous line from the Kotzker Rebbe. You know, I've quoted him a number of times, right? Always has little nice ones. And he says like this. He says, if I am I, because I am I, and you are you because you are you, then I am I and you are you. But, he says, if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. That's a real classic Kotzker, right? And that concept is so true. In other words, we need to live not through the lens of other people. We need to live through our own lens. That's really important. We have to embrace ourselves rather than what we think we're supposed to be in terms of the way people perceive us, right? There's also the very famous concept that was said by Rabbi Zusha, famous tzaddik, the Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Zusha of Anipoli, who said the following. He said that he knows that when comes a time for the soul to leave the world, right, there's a, what we call a din v'cheshbon, there's a reckoning. That's what happens when we come to the world of truth. And he says he's not afraid at all about being asked, Zusha, why weren't you like Abraham and Sarah? Or why weren't you like Moshe Rabbeinu? He says he's not afraid of that because he wasn't meant to be like Abraham or Moshe Rabbeinu. He is afraid, however, he says, I am afraid of being asked, Zusha, why weren't you Zusha? Okay. So that's all true. But then let's go back to what the Kotzker said, right? When he said, I am I because I am I, that's a good thing, then I am I, right? But what is the I? This is what we need to understand. What is the I? Is the I my needs? Is the I my personality? Focus on self? Or is the I my values, my higher purpose, my selflessness, my soul? Right? What is the I that we're talking about here? In other words, is the I something much deeper than my personality? It's just that I need to acknowledge my personality? Or is the I my personality, right? So, you know, it comes back to something we've discussed many times, but we need to bring it in to get it very clear. Because I've had this discussion recently with parents. It was overseas, I was doing a parenting thing overseas, and there's a tremendous push nowadays, and then it becomes an extreme push, like everything else, with the pendulum syndrome that we've talked about many times. There was a time where parents were very demanding and very harsh, and very judgmental of their children, right? As Rabbi Twersky writes, that sometimes parents view their children as nachas machines, right? And that's not what it's supposed to be, right? Each child is different, each child is individual. So now they've moved in a good way, or partly in a good way. They know the focus needs to be is acceptance. You need to unconditionally love your children. But the pendulum syndrome concept that I'm finding with that is that it's swung all the way to the other, that it's only unconditional love. All you need to do is unconditional love. You know, bring up kids, just show them unconditional love, and that's it. Everything will sort out. I can reliably tell you that everything will not sort out, right? It's not going to happen. So, some parents I was talking to were struggling with this. So I explained to them in the following way, using a concept that we've talked about many times. I said, you're mixing up two things, right? Of course you have to have unconditional love with your children. But where does the unconditional love come from? And what are you loving? What are you unconditionally loving? Are you loving the fact that they smashed the window and were revealed, they were acting wildly? Well, I don't. I mean, no, not at all. Right? So do you love the child even though they smashed the window and they knew they shouldn't have? Yes, no, maybe. How does that work, right? So I said you need to go to the fundamental Jewish concept which we've talked about so many times. And that is that we are layered into five layers. Three conscious layers of cognition, emotion, and behavior. The fourth layer is the subconscious. And then we've got the intrinsic core soul. The spark of God that is infused within every single one of us, right? Where we know, and I'm not going to go through that in length because we've done this 100 times, but where we know that the personality lives on the four layers. That's where our strengths and weaknesses live. That's where our failures and successes live. Those are ours. We've talked about many times the garments of our soul, which we need to own and take responsibility for us, but they're not the real self. The real self is the fifth layer. Our intrinsic spark, our intrinsic purity, our intrinsic worth, our intrinsic godliness, which is always intact. It is always intact. And it creates a bond between us and God and between parents and children. Right? So we've always given this analogy of a person has a child, a baby is born, and as soon as the baby is born, there's this incredible love between parent and child. What are we loving? Notwithstanding we think that an hour-old baby is the smartest and cutest in the whole world, which they're actually not, right? So what are we loving then? We're loving our child, because it's my child. And there's an unconditional, unbreakable, non-negotiable bond that exists between a parent and child. That's where God created us. That's what I'm loving. It's my child. Right? And at that point in the child's life, functionality and behavior and personality doesn't matter. It's not supposed to matter. But as the child grows up, right? And the same thing between us and God, by the way. Right? As the child grows up and starts to go to school, and starts to learn how to behave, it's our responsibility as parents to then not accept bad behavior. Now, of course, in a positive way, not being harsh and so on, but we can do it positively, but still to be demanding. And to say, no, this behavior is unacceptable. And when it happens, and that's why because at that point what happens is that unconditional bond goes into the background and we're more focused on the functionality of the child, the behavior of the child. And we train the child, you must do your homework and you must behave like a mensch. And it's important not to break windows and not to be destructive and to be nice to other people and to share with your siblings and so on and so forth, right? Now, it is true that what we need to learn to do as parents is that when they break those rules and they make themselves very unlovable, right, to reconnect to the love which I have for the essence of the child, the essential love, right? In other words, the conditional love and the setting boundaries and limits around the bad behavior is two different parts of the soul. It's not the same part of the soul. It's not the same part of the child. Am I making sense? Is this, yeah? In other words, I unconditionally love the child because I accept, both with myself and my children and those around me, hopefully, that the essence of the person is not their behavior. They're responsible for the behavior, but the essence of the person is not their behavior. The essence of the person is their intrinsic value, their worthiness. Right? And that's what I always have to remember as a parent, to unconditionally accept the child because they will always remain worthy. And if I can always love them, I love them because they're intrinsically worthy. Because they have an intrinsic soul which has never been broken, never been damaged. Right? At the same time, when I show that love to the child and I say to the child, look, I really do believe in you, but I'm not going to accept what happens on the other layers because I believe you've got intrinsic value and intrinsic worthiness, I believe you can do better on those other layers. And both things need to be shown. And that's to be that sort of combination and balance, right? And the same thing, therefore, is when it comes to ourselves, right? By the way, this is a concept we've talked about many times before Rosh Hashanah, why we always have this concept of Avinu and Malkeinu, right? So just to play it out a little bit, not it's the wrong time of the year, but nevertheless, right? We say Avinu Malkeinu every day in our prayers, actually. So we have this concept that we refer to God as our Father and as our King. And it's really the same sort of idea. That when we've messed up and we want to reconnect with God, we say, listen, we need to reconnect with you because ultimately you cannot reject us because you are our Father. And we strip down the relationship to the core essence and we say, look, your essence loves our essence. We're always connected. And God accepts that. But once that happens, once we rekindle the relationships on a level of unconditional love, we then have to go to Malkeinu. A king is much more about functionality. A king is about rules. A king is about functionality. The country has to function. Right? A king doesn't love everyone, he just wants it to function, right? He wants the country to survive and to create and to produce and to be productive and so on. So that's the same sort of idea. And that's the core of this problem that I was having with being enough, right? Because we're not enough. Why are we not enough? We're worthy, not enough. Why? Because enough is about my personality, it's about what I do, it's about what I accomplish. And we're actually never enough. Because we're supposed to grow, and we're supposed to fix, and we're supposed to improve, and we're supposed to take responsibility. Because self-acceptance and self-love doesn't, it's acknowledging our personality. But it's really about feeling the intrinsic worthiness, which comes from the fifth layer of our soul. Understand? If I'm a lazy person, or I'm an angry person, or I'm a jealous person, that's not enough. But it doesn't make me unworthy. That's a difference. Why does it make me unworthy? Because I've got that fifth layer of the soul. Because I'm intrinsically worthy. And God loves me. And I'm on a journey. And because I make a mistake, the mistake doesn't define me. Why? Because what defines me is that fifth layer, not the four layers. The four layers, as we've spoken about many times, are my garments. Meaning I take responsibility for them. I need to work with them. I need to nurture them through my own journey, through the talents and the skill set that God has given me in my unique mission, not everyone else's mission, right? But what defines me is not those layers. What defines me is the intrinsic essence of my core identity, which is my soul. And what lives at that soul? What lives in the core essence of my soul? A connection, a purity, a godly spark, which comes with the aspiration for meaning, for purpose, and for values. And the aspiration to always live by my values, but at the same time, not to beat myself up when I make a mistake in accordance with my values, but just to keep aspiring and to take responsibility and keep improving each one according to their own ability. Is that clear? All right. So, because self, when I say I, right, being who I am, the I stems from that purity of the soul. Therefore, tied up with the I is that desire to live by values, the desire to connect to something higher than myself, the desire to grow beyond myself, to connect with a higher being. And therefore, to be selfless. So the real I is actually selfless rather than selfish. But selfless in a positive way, not selfless in a negative way. Not negative selflessness or negative humility. It's about being selfish in terms of I'm always striving to make room. I'm always striving to make room for something higher. Right? Let me share with you just to... Because in other words, what's the forefront of my life, therefore, is my value system. Now, obviously, there needs to be self. Obviously, we need to create boundaries. That's what I spoke about last week. Obviously, we need to take care of ourselves. But that's not what we're about. What we're about is growing. Now, in order to grow, you have to be there. In order to grow, you have to take care of yourself. In order to grow, you have to self-protect sometimes, right? But that's not the purpose. The core purpose is the growth, the improvement, the character development, the spirituality, the connection with God, the connection with something higher, that concept. That's who I really am. Now, I've got a lot of weaknesses, a lot of faults, that doesn't define me. If I don't feel unworthy, even though I've got them, but I acknowledge them, and I acknowledge them, and I acknowledge them in the context where I'm working on them, and I'm taking responsibility for them. Right? I think that's where this sort of difference becomes. I'll share with you an interesting Kabbalistic idea. that the Zohar talks about, as explained by later mystical authors and so on. And in the beginning of history, they connect three people. One is Eve, who took from the forbidden fruit. One is Noah, who came later, Noah and the flood. And the third is Sarah, the Amatriarch Sarah, right? And in Zohar, they connect these three and they say it's like one journey. Each one was trying to build on the other. So what happened was, we know when God created the world, there was a commandment not to eat from the forbidden fruit, right? At the end of the day, Eve had this temptation, the snake, the whole story, and she took the fruit and she gave it to Adam, and they ate from the forbidden fruit, right? So in Hasidic philosophy, in Kabbalistic philosophy, it explains the following. What was Eve's mistake? Eve's mistake was a negative sense of self. Because the way God created Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden was that they had a sense of total connection to God. So they were created, so to speak, with the ability of total selflessness and total non-focus on self altogether. And Eve didn't want that. She wanted self-indulgence. She wanted to feel self. Now, in a positive way, there's nothing wrong with feeling self if it's for the right reason, but she didn't. So Eve made a mistake. She wanted to eat the fruit because it tastes good. Because I want it, so it's good. Sense of self. That's me. The fact that God gave me a commandment, I have to eat it, and I've got only 3 hours that I have to hold myself back and not eat it. Because as the Talmud and the Kabbalah tells us that the whole thing was only for 3 hours. If they would have had self-control for 3 hours, it would have been permitted afterwards. They would have in fact, according to many commentaries, it was a grape. The forbidden fruit was grape, and when Shabbat came in, they would have made kiddush on the juice of the grape, and that would have been a whole different existence. But no, she wanted it, and wanted it then and now, so therefore, sense of self. Okay. So, and that was really the purpose. It wasn't so much the grape that she needed to eat, it was more about asserting self, which was negative at the time. So Noah came along and wanted to fix that. So I don't know if you know the story in the Torah, that's a by the way story that appears in the Parashah, the story of the flood. When Noah comes out of the ark and he has to re-inhabit the world, the first thing he does is he plants a vineyard so that he can make wine. He drinks wine and gets intoxicated with negative consequences. Now Noah wasn't just a drunk, he wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, don't forget he'd been a year in recovery, right? Even if he was. But he wasn't, right? He'd been in the ark, but there was no wine. But anyway, he didn't drink wine before either. He wasn't a drunk. So why did he get drunk all of a sudden? Right? And Kabbalah says that the reason he did that was because he recognized the sin of Eve. He recognized the sin of Eve, that it was sense of self. And mistakenly, he said, well then, I'm going to fix that, and I'm going to get rid of the sense of self. I'm going to escape self. So he got drunk. Drunk is the way to escape self, right? Big mistake. Because you don't escape self by denying self. Right? Who began the journey of fixing what Eve had done in the beginning? Kabbalah says Sarah did that. Why? Because by Sarah we are taught that she lived a very up and down life. She had lots of struggles, lots of ups and downs. Right? She was childless, and then she was kidnapped by Pharaoh in Egypt, and but then she had a child eventually, all back and forth, right? And yet the Torah tells us through a whole way of interpreting the verse over there that Sarah lived a life where kulan shavin letova, that all her years were equal, they were all equally good. All equally good. Commentators ask the question, how can you say they were equally good? They weren't. She had lots of ups and downs. She had years of pain, years of happiness, years of smooth years, years of struggle, right? What do you mean they were all good? Oh. So the Kabbalah teaches that Sarah was the one to understand what true sense of self is. Sarah didn't deny herself. She didn't even deny her struggles. But she understood what true self is. True self is the soul. True self is the values. True self is the connection with God, and true self is selflessness. And therefore, Sarah went through years of ups and downs. She never denied her pain. She never denied her struggles when they were there. But she never defined herself by them. What she defined herself was, the way she defined herself was by her core essence, by her value, by her connection with God. And therefore, no matter what the circumstance was, the focus wasn't her struggle, the focus was her value. The struggle was there, and she did not, and she acknowledged it, as we should always. If we have pain, we should acknowledge the pain and accommodate that, make accommodations for the pain. If we're having struggle, we should acknowledge the struggle. We should live wholeheartedly, as she says in the book. And we should be honest with it. That's authentic. Because our outer four layers are still our layers, still part of us, but they're not us. So we need to acknowledge that. We need to acknowledge that it's part of self. It's part of the journey. It's part of who we are. It's part of being authentic. But they never define who we are. What defines Sarah was, she acknowledged all of that, but she says, my focus is not me. My focus is how can I always connect to something higher? How can I become better? And how can I live my values no matter what the circumstance is? Right? Now, this is not easy. Right? It's not easy at all. Because what it means is, it means when she talks about being vulnerable, about showing up wholeheartedly and living who we are, that means living who we are, truly who we are. That means living by my values. Which means it's a bit two opposite things that have to go together. That's why I don't like this word enough, because it's about being authentic, and it's about sharing our weaknesses, but not defining ourselves by weaknesses, but at the same time, not saying that the weaknesses don't define us, and therefore we're always worthy, but we're still not enough. It's about acknowledging that they exist, and this is who I am at the moment. But my core self, my core intrinsic value, is working to improve. You know where this plays out a lot, and nowadays, I'll tell you why I'm so passionate about this. I've had lots of conversations like this, but just a recent one. With someone who's, you know, not here, but someone who's a therapist. And shared with me, without giving away any identities, no one, but shared with me that just recently, noticing a trend in a particular community, where people are coming. Now, let's be very clear, we've talked about this before. The Torah values marriage, but also gives a way out when it's needed. So there are relationships that are toxic, and there are relationships that need to come to an end, and so on and so forth, right? And sometimes it's the job of a therapist and the job of a professional to actually facilitate that process. Unfortunately, I've done it myself. I'm not a therapist, but I've done it more than once where I told people, listen, I don't know why you know, this is just not going to work. You're better off, you know. Okay, that's true. There's a lot of room for that. But there's a trend developing nowadays that's very different. People are living their lives. They can be married for 30 years. Decent. They will tell you themselves that not terrible. Right? And then just like, you know, they've had enough. That's enough. Genug, as they say in Yiddish, right? I want to pursue other stuff. I'm not getting maximum stuff out of it, whatever, all kinds of things. I'm just like ending it, right? It's a very troubling trend. Or you got people who actually are not entering into committed relationships altogether. Very, very big trend today. Are people who just don't want to commit to any relationship. Because they know that if you commit to a relationship, you've got to give of yourself. And in fact, you have to change yourself. And you have to do things that are uncomfortable. You have to compromise. And you have to make accommodation for other people. You have to make room for other things, other people. And you have to stop. You can't just say, that's me. And they don't want to do that. Right? Why? Because they are taking this concept of being enough to an extreme. This is who I am. I want to be authentic. I don't want to bluff anyone. So I can't play a game. This is just who I am. So who am I fooling? So what's the answer? Don't commit to a relationship. Leave a relationship. Right? And that's not what's meant to happen. Authenticity doesn't mean that. Again, apart from the times where it's unavoidable and it's toxic and needs to end. But authenticity means I acknowledge who I am and I realize and I'm connecting completely and I'm being totally honest. And therefore I am going to change. I am going to work on myself. It's going to take time. Don't judge me. Please accept me the way I am for now. But I commit to changing. And what I'm going to ask you to do and what I'm going to do at the same time is to reward direction, not perfection, like Rick LaVoy says. So it's not going to happen overnight. Right? It's going to happen at my pace. It's going to happen the way I can do it. And I am going to improve. And I'm going to work hard. And I'm going to invest the effort. Because I'm worthy, but I'm not enough. It's a big mistake. Now, all that comes because I don't want to live as I. I want to live by the real I. And my real I is values. And values means hard work. That's just a fact of life. We're put here to work hard. Now, the work hard is worth it. It brings amazing happiness. Living by values, all research will tell you, living by value-based living brings happiness, brings contentment, brings inner fulfillment. But it is hard work. And the hard work does not come from saying I'm not worthy. It comes from saying I am worthy. But the worthiness comes from the true essence of who I am, not my outer layers. My outer layers are something I have to take responsibility for and work with and improve on in my way, in using the skills that God has given me, and so on. Right? So therefore, self-acceptance means accepting the fifth layer of the soul and acknowledging everything else and then running with it in the best way we can and working with it the best way we can. So in conclusion, therefore, I'll go through three things she says at the end in terms of tools. We absolutely need to be authentic, and authentic is not easy. And authentic does mean, and this is what I want to bring out again also, authentic is true. Authentic does not mean I live my life by what everyone else thinks, but it does mean I live my life by my values. Which, by the way, living our life by values sometimes means I do care about what someone else says. Pirkei Avot tells us that, in a good sense. See, if I live my life just because I want to be me and accept the whole of me just because that's me, and therefore I'm going to start being authentic and not care what anyone else thinks, I'm going to end up really not caring what everyone else thinks. And I'm not going to be a nice guy to live around. Pirkei Avot says that we have to behave in a way where we foster relationships, where we make morality attractive, where even if I live by my values, part of that is for people to, you know, there's a concept in the Talmud that if you're doing something and it looks bad, that's not a good thing. You shouldn't say, well, I know I've done the right thing. No, sometimes you also have to do the right thing in the eyes, as the pasuk, as the verse says, in the eyes of God and the eyes of man. Why? Because you do have to care what other people think. Not to define your life what other people think when it's not relevant, right? So if you're a good parent and you know that for you to be a good parent, your kid needs to throw a tantrum in the middle of calls, that's fine. Doesn't matter what anyone else thinks, right? And if you're tired and your house is not completely tidied up and a neighbor knocks on the door, it is not the end of the world. Even if they think you're a very bad balabost, as they would say in Yiddish, right? It doesn't matter. People should have their priorities straight. So yeah, we do have to have a sense of priorities. And if you need to create some boundaries because we just have to be honest what we're capable of doing or not capable of doing, even though we might aspire, maybe come a later stage to do more, we need to know that right now I can't sort of participate in that kindness activity because I'm just finished. And I need to do other things which are also important. That's all good. That's all true. But part of that value system is also, yes, to accommodate other people and to accommodate the feelings of other people when it's appropriate and when it's relevant and when it's value-based. So I'm not being defined by other people, I'm being defined by my values, but sometimes that means my values dictate that I have to accommodate other people and consider other people's feelings and so on and so forth, right? So authenticity is incredibly important, and therefore that leads to healthy vulnerability where we can acknowledge, we can say, look, I'm struggling with this now. I'm gonna work on it, but I am struggling with it. It's just, you know, that's my struggle, and that's my weakness, and I have made a mistake, and that's fine. I learn from my mistake. Nothing defines me, that's all good. So, and that's hard, because sometimes we want to hide that, we want to be perfect, and we want people to think that we haven't made any mistakes. That's negative, and that's just 1,000% right. That's why, in that sense, healthy vulnerability is very good, to be able to share, and to be authentic, to be honest. But the honesty is not that I'm enough, the honesty is that I'm worthy. And because I'm worthy, I'm lovable. In other words, I can expect to be loved and accepted by people, by God, by everyone else, because I'm worthy. Not because I'm enough, but because I'm worthy. So the worthiness deserves love. And therefore we shouldn't judge each other. And we shouldn't criticize each other, and so on and so forth. Yes, that's all true. But we should also not become self-absorbed. So the I that we talk about, accepting the I am I, that has to be that intrinsic I, the worthy I, the value-based I. Now to do that, as she says, takes a lot of practice. So, you know, she has this thing about dig deep. The dig is deliberate, inspired, and going. So she says you've got to build confidence. She says find a mantra, a word, or saying that grounds you. You know, so she says she always says to herself when she's feeling vulnerable and she's worried about other people's perception. She says she says to herself, stand on your sacred ground, don't puff, don't shrink, that kind of thing. So yeah, it is. It's reminding ourselves all the time about that self-worth that we really have. We have to inspire ourselves by things that we read, by learning about our intrinsic value and so forth and so forth. And then we have to just make it a goal. We have to make it a goal to be honest and authentic. In other words, like I say, it's not just a perspective of authenticity, it's actually a real action. We actually have to be authentic. Like if, you know, we're faced with a lemon, I'm not going to share with that friend, you know. Do it. Be vulnerable. It's a risk, but we can do it. But it's got to be done on the basis of understanding our own self-worth and our intrinsic value. Okay, there's many more areas of life where this manifests itself, which will go into some interesting concepts and chapters over the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, have a wonderful day.